Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
You've tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Dr. Nicole M. Avena received a PhD in psychology and neuroscience from Princeton University and completed her postdoctoral fellowship at Rockefeller University. She's a pioneering research neuroscientist and expert in the fields of nutrition, diet, and addiction. She's the author of several books on nutrition and early development and has published over 100 scholarly journal articles. Dr. Avena is an assistant professor of neuroscience at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York and a visiting professor in health psychology at Princeton University. Dr. Avena joins me via the Zoom platform. Dr. Avena, welcome to 411 Teen.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, I look forward to talking with you. Your book, Sugarless, I enjoyed it. It was very thorough and informative. So thanks for taking the time to share your expertise on sugar.
You know, I'm happy to. It's such a, I don't even know if we'll have enough time to cover all the main points.
Well, that means I have to have you come back. Okay, that's what we'll establish that now. But I know your study for sugar dates all the way back to your early days in graduate school at Princeton. What was the impetus for you to investigate sugar? It was not a popular topic, and in some circles, it was not even considered worthy of your academic pursuit. So tell us, how did you get there?
Well, it's interesting. Like you said, I had just started my PhD at Princeton, and I was working with my advisor on what project I might do for my dissertation, which is this, you know, really big endeavor that's supposed to take multiple years to accomplish. And at the time, you know, we were hearing a lot about obesity rates going up. This is back in the year 2000, 2001. And one of the things that was interesting to me was the fact that, you know, a lot of the onus for obesity and being overweight was being placed on the person, on the individual. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of thought as a moral failing or the lack of willpower.
Exactly.
And, you know, I kind of thought that it seemed a little curious that our food environment had been changing quite a bit over that past 50 years. I mean, you know, from 1950 to the year 2000, we saw a huge shift in the types of foods that we had access to and the amount of food that was available. And so we started talking about, well, you know, maybe now that we have so many processed foods that have an awful lot of sugar in them, could it be the food that's causing obesity? Mm-hmm. Could there be something about the foods that people eat that maybe are getting them hooked on it, addicted to it, maybe? And so that's where it began. And you're right. In the beginning, it wasn't all that well received. I had quite a few colleagues who thought it was a silly thing to look at and didn't really understand, you know, the point of understanding if sugar could be an addictive substance. And, you know, I think now in hindsight, I'm glad I kind of, you know, ignored the naysayers because now we've conducted so many research studies and other labs have conducted studies that have complemented ours and really added to this growing story of the fact that sugar can be an addictive substance. It meets the criteria for addiction. And that is really part of the reason why so many people are struggling with eating healthy these days.
Well, when you say addiction, for the listening audience, will you explain what you mean? Really, what is the criteria for addiction? Because I think so many people think, you can be addicted to nicotine. You can be addicted to caffeine. But sugar? You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and what we did as, you know, careful scientists that we were and are, is to be careful that we were defining addiction very clearly, because you're right, addiction is a term that gets thrown around a lot colloquially. And people say they're addicted to their smartphone, or, you know, they're addicted to certain shows on television. Right. And when we were talking about addiction, we were using the medical condition, the diagnostic condition that the American Psychiatric Association describes in their book, The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And in that book, the American Psychiatric Association outlines the criteria that need to be met in order for someone to be diagnosed as having a substance use disorder. So if somebody, you know, were to come to the hospital or go to their doctor and, you know, is having trouble with alcohol and they meet the criteria for having, you know, an addiction to alcohol, they would be given that diagnosis. So what we did was we used those criteria, but we simply inserted the word sugar as the drug. And we conducted initially a lot of studies in our laboratory rats, in part because, you know, it's hard to find control subjects that haven't had sugar. And, you know, in part also because we were interested in the brain and wanted to see what was happening on the neural level to understand, you know, how sugar was impacting neurochemicals in the brain. And so there's been quite a few studies that have been conducted, you know, in humans now, looking at these very same things that we initially looked at in rats. And at the end of the day, what we're able to demonstrate is that sugar does meet those American Psychiatric Association criteria for being an addictive substance, just like alcohol, just like nicotine, morphine, you know, and a lot of the other drugs that are out there.
What are some of the conditions that have, are identified in the DSM for being addicted? I mean, I just want the listening audience to have an idea of what addiction is. It is not a character flaw, okay, as you well know, but so often people see it as, oh, well, it's just a character flaw, and it is physiological. So if you would just share a couple, just a couple of the characteristics of addiction.
You're right. And it's so important that we remind people that addiction is not a character flaw, because even though we have known this for many years now, there unfortunately still are people that are just not aware of it. And they think it's a moral failing and that, you know, they're not necessarily aware of the biological basis for an addiction. And so when we were looking at the criteria for addiction that were laid out by the American Psychiatric Association, you know, we're looking at things like having a desire to limit the amount that you are consuming, but you're unable to, or spending an extraordinary amount of time thinking about how you're going to get access to the substance or planning your use of the substance, or withdrawal. Withdrawal can be one of the characteristics of addiction. So that can be, you know, experienced in a variety of different ways for drugs like nicotine, for example, which is probably the closest withdrawal to sugar. It can be things like irritability. It can be, you know, feelings of anxiousness. It can be feelings of lethargy when you don't have access to the substance. And craving is another one. Craving the substance, meaning that, you know, you have this desire, this persistent desire to get access to the substance that can occupy your thoughts in ways that can be disruptive to your everyday way of living. So the thing about addiction is that it's a spectrum. You're not addicted or not. You can be mildly addicted, or you can have a severe form of an addiction. And so that's why it's important for us to be aware. And I have in my book, Sugarless, a quiz that people can take that can help them to see, you know, these different criteria and also to understand where they might fall on the spectrum. Because the reality is most of us are at risk for developing a sugar addiction just because of the pervasiveness of sugar in our society. And many of us are minimally addicted, if not more than that.
Well, it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous, okay? I mean, breast milk is sweet, okay? How does one identify and identify the sugar content and avoid it also, because it just seems like, in reading your book, I was just so enlightened. I mean, because it seemed like I can't get away from it.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned breast milk, and that's part of the reason why we are drawn to it, because we evolved from hunters and gatherers. And, you know, our ancestors very rarely had sugar. They would maybe stumble upon a berry bush once in a while. And when they did, they would eat all the berries that were sweet and ripe and delicious. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, coded in our brains as being safe and good for us. And so in nature, we have this pairing of sweetness with safety. And even amongst our young, the very first thing that babies taste is breast milk, which is sweet. And so that is an evolutionary advantage that we developed. But the problem is that our food industry and our food environment has evolved much more rapidly than our brains have. And so we still have those, you know, primitive hunter or gatherer brains that, you know, taste things that are sweet and think it's safe and good for us. But the problem is that sugar is everywhere and it's not always good for us. And it's in things like candy bars and, you know, these cereals that are loaded with sugar.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Coffees and all of these things that have very little, if no, nutritional value other than calories. And that's where we are struggling these days because it is a biological drive to want to have sugar, but we have to have this rational approach to our consumption because we know that it's not good for us anymore.
Well, you know, Madison Avenue plays a big role in shaping our sugar consumption, particularly among children, okay? You think about, you know, everything, it seems like that they like their sugary cereals. Granola has tons of sugar. So everything that they seem to be used to eating or enjoy eating has a lot of sugar in it. I mean, even when you're in the grocery store and you're getting ready to go out, the sugary items are placed right there at the checkout aisle. So the kids, they're right on eye level because they're sitting in the cart as their mom empties it out. And they are, you know, looking at all these good things to eat, you know, that aren't really that good. So I wanted to have us talk about that as I look at the clock. It's time for us to take a quick break. But when we come back, I'd like to have you, you know, address Madison Avenue and sugar. I'm talking with Dr. Nicole Avena, and she has written a dynamic new book called Sugarless and exploring sugar in our environment. Dr. Avena, right before we went on break, I was just talking about Madison Avenue and the role that it plays with kids and sugar. Did you want to respond to that or comment on those?
You are absolutely right. And I think that we need to be mindful of this, that, you know, sugar has been normalized to some degree. And this is particularly an issue when it comes to our little ones. And, you know, the fact that you brought up about, you know, having candy bars at checkout aisles and, you know, it's really playing upon the consumer. And I think it's taking advantage of consumers that have young kids who are, you know, just trying to get out of the store. They're trying to pay for what they want and they got to, you know, get these kids home and with as little incident as possible. And really, when you dangle these candy bars in front of kids like that, I mean, what do you expect parents to do, right?
Yes, you and can so, have it. Take it. Just let me get
exactly.
through.
Exactly. Yes.
And, you know, been there, done that.
it's really, really unfair. And even for us that don't have young children, you know, it's something where there's no need for it, but it's become this omnipresent feature in our day-to-day living. When you go to a checkout from a store, here's the candy, here's the, you know, the snacks. Mm-hmm. Even the other day I had a run into, you know, the just to local, you know, office supply store to get some printer paper. And I was shocked that they had a full thing of candy, all these different, to check out. And I thought, why do you need candy when you're just buying computer paper or ink? But it's become normalized. And I think that, you know, it's part of the reason why a lot of people don't realize they're addicted to sugar. And it's just become so commonplace that we expect to see it everywhere. And so it's not something that people are concerned about. And it contributes to passive consumption. And I'd like to call it secondhand consumption of sugar, just like we have secondhand smoking, you know, when people around you are smoking and you end up being, you know, harmed by the fumes.
Right. Yeah.
Well, the same thing happens with sugar. You know, just because somebody decides there should be sugar in every aisle of the store, you know, we end up being victims in that because we end up, all right, well, let's just get a bar. Suddenly now I feel like having candy. So, oh, here, look, here's some for me to purchase. So I think it is a big issue that we need to address because it's shaping our environment, and the environment is really what's going to be driving our behavior.
That's true. And as we talk about children, I'm just thinking, you know, we use sugary products, put it that way, food, as a reward for children. That's real commonplace. What do you think about that? I mean, what message are we sending? You know, you do well on your report card and you get a cupcake. You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I think that we basically took a behavior that used to make sense. So if you think about like Victorian times, you had access to sugar maybe twice a year. You would give a orange to your most treasured loved one because it was so rare. It was something that was really a special, special thing that we hardly ever had. And it was a way to show love. And it was an amazing gift to give to somebody. But I think we have that same mindset now, but we've transposed it into a time period where, you know, sugar's everywhere and it's actually not good for us. And yet we still find that we use it as a way to show affection and to show love. And, you know, I think amongst children, this is a really big issue. And I personally struggle with this. I have little kids. And in my one daughter's elementary school, you know, they give candy out.
Yes.
I mean, for everything. My daughter came into the car the other day with a lollipop and said she got it because she delivered the paperwork up to the front office for the teacher. I mean, so, you know, we're rewarding our kids for just doing normal behavioral stuff and being good by giving them sweets. And again, I don't think there's anything nefarious about it in the sense that, you know, schools and parents are doing this on purpose. But I do think we need to be more mindful about it because the message that we're sending to our kids is, oh, if you do something good, give yourself sugar as a reward.
And the other
that's not good.
Oh, the other thing I was going to say, which is another whole topic, is we're rewarding them for things they should be doing in the first place. I got a problem. That's my own thing, but I got a problem. Okay, I asked you to take something up to the office. I don't need to, in my opinion, I don't need to reward you for that, okay? If you cleared off the desk, that's good. I appreciate it. I let you know I appreciate it. You know, nonverbal communication. I can look at you. I can smile. I can give you a pat on the back, whatever. But I don't have to give you a cookie or a piece of gum or whatever. I just think that sends the wrong, that's my own thing, but that's another sidebar. We can go in. It's like the kids that play on you know, peewee teams. Everybody gets a trophy. Well, everybody is not good. Okay.
you are right. And I think that, you know, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. We've basically become a society that rewards people for just doing what they're supposed to do anyway.
Right.
Like, you're just supposed to do it. There's no reward involved. You just do it.
Just do it.
So I don't know when that happened. I'd like to pinpoint the year that we switched to that, because when I was a kid, we didn't have that. We just had to behave.
You just had to behave. That's right. You do this. Teacher told you to do it, and you do it, and that's good. Okay. Talk about a little bit the detrimental effects on the brain and the body that sugar has.
Well, you know, I think that I initially got interested in this because of obesity and being overweight mm-hmm. as major public health issues, but it goes well beyond that. And what we've learned is that sugar can have an impact on so many different health conditions. It is associated with cardiovascular disease. It's associated with fatty liver disease. And it's associated with certain types of cancers. Beyond that, what we're seeing, and I think this is one of the more interesting components of the sugar story lately, is that sugar has been linked to our cognitive functioning mm-hmm. to the point where some people have argued that Alzheimer's disease and dementia are in many ways almost like a type 3 diabetes because of the mm-hmm. link between sugar and how it can impact brain health in a negative way. And another part of it is our mental health. And one of the things that is so surprising to people, I think, when they are able to reduce their added sugar intake and break away from it, is how it impacts their mood. And, you know, I think a lot of people use sugar as a way to self-medicate their anxiety or self-medicate, you know, the daily stressors of life that can sometimes, you know, get to us. And when they reduce their added sugar, it's amazing how people will feel like their mood improves and they mm-hmm. feel more even and they don't feel like they have those ups and downs throughout the day. And so the impact on our mental well-being and our mental health, I think, is critical because, you know, we're having a crisis in this country right now with mental health, especially mm-hmm. among young people. And I think that our food environment is in part to blame for that. And if we can help people to eat healthier and get sugar out of their diets, reduce it, that is certainly going to help them to feel better. And it's certainly going to be a step toward positive mental health.
I have been talking with Dr. Avina, and we are talking about sugar. She has a new book out called Sugarless. And Dr. Avina, share with, you know, because we'll start, keep talking and talking, and I'll forget we are here. I want people to know about this book. I found it very informative, very provocative. I just thought it was just really fantastic. Will you share where one can purchase this book? Because we'll continue, and I will not have said anything about your book.
Yes. So Sugarless, A 7-Step Plan to Uncover Hidden Sugars, Curb Your Cravings, and Conquer Your Addiction. It's available wherever books are sold. It's out now in stores. You can also find it on Amazon or on barnesandnobles.com. And you can also find it on my website, Dr. Nicole Avina. If you want to order a signed copy, you're welcome to go there and get one. And I will gladly have a signed one sent to you.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's Dr. Nicole Avina, A-V-E-N-A, okay, for my listening audience. Great, that sounds good. As we're talking about sugar, there's a big link between sugar addiction and, how do I say, I guess economic disparities and communities who live in food deserts and how they are really almost forced to consume large amounts of sugar. I was just thinking about someone that was just on the news the other day, and he was saying in his community they lived 15 miles from the nearest grocery store. And that might not be that bad in a big city. 15 miles is nothing. But you know, if you're in a rural area and it's 15 miles and the only place you have access to is Dollar General, that creates a problem. That's going to influence what one can buy at the store. And if it's 15 miles away, I mean, if you don't have transportation, how are you going to get there? So you're forced. You're kind of put in a situation that you are forced to get what's in these stores. And I don't think, now I may be, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that there's fresh produce in these dollar stores. I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with that they have produce and meat and protein. Or if they do, it's in the form of a granola bar. So you get your protein. Oh, get your protein from this granola bar, that's another whole story. But in any event, talk about that. And what's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's awful that we have so many Americans, millions mm-hmm. of Americans living in food deserts, in places where they don't have easy access to large grocery stores that has a variety of fresh foods available. And you're right, in these situations, people are essentially forced to live off of processed foods. Because if you go and do your grocery shopping at, you know, a dollar store or, you know, even a corner market, mm-hmm. right? If you think about it, I mean, if I was the owner of the corner store, I wouldn't want to stock it with vegetables and fruits right. that are going to go bad in a couple days.
Right.
Because that's going to eat into my profits. I'd want to stock it with things that'll last on the shelf for 6 months or more.
Of course.
And, you know, it's just doesn't make business sense. And so what happens is that, you know, many of these places just don't have those types of foods available, don't have fresh foods available. So people are forced to consume processed food that has a lot of added sugar in it. And, you know, when you take a look at the maps of the United States, the countries that have the most food deserts are also the countries that have the lower socioeconomic mm-hmm. status. They also have less education. And unfortunately, they also have the most illness. Mm. And again, it comes back to what we're eating. A lot of these issues, I think, could be mitigated to a significant degree if we were able to get better foods into the hands of people, because we know, you know, food affects everything. And even with sugar, we haven't touched on this, but our immune system,
yeah,
it's definitely impacted by our diet. And when you are eating excess amounts of sugar, it compromises your immune system. And that puts you at risk for being ill and having to miss work and losing out on income. And it's mm-hmm. a vicious cycle that emerges that people often find that they're stuck in. And, you know, that's even independent of the addiction part. That's a social construct that we need to rectify. But when you layer the addiction on top of that, then it really becomes a challenge for a lot of people to make the changes that they need to make in order to turn their health around.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about some of the things that I read in your book, and they were just so enlightening, because I think folks, even who consider themselves, you know, somewhat erudite and can think they have read things, when I started reading that, I was thinking, you don't think about the impact of sugar and where it is in your world, what role it plays. At least I didn't. I put it that way. You know, I didn't think about it. I don't think that's something folks are aware of. So that's why I applaud and just jumped on the opportunity to talk with you and interview you on the program, because I felt like you had so much to share, and so you could really educate myself and the listening audience. Before we go right ahead.
Oh, I was going to say thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm grateful to be here to be able to talk about this, because these are such important issues mm-hmm. that you're right. I don't think we're not talking about them enough. And raising awareness is really something that we need to do. We need to spread the word so that we can make some changes to improve people's health.
And we need to spread the word in key places. No, I love teachers, no disrespect to teachers, but they need to find other ways to reinforce behaviors or to reward children. Even I know grapes are nothing but little sugar balls, but they're better than a lollipop.
Absolutely.
Okay, would you agree? Good. I thought I was hoping that I was right. I said that kind of like, well, maybe I know they're nothing but balls of sugar. But anyhow, sugar, how do we identify it? How do we know that, you know, it's fructose and sucrose? And how do we identify sugar in a food item? Do you have any kind of key way that you would suggest that what we look for in sugar? I know I used to go with the O-S-E. If it had anything like that, that meant it was sugar.
Yes, that's a great tip. Anything that ends in an O-S is typically a form of a sugar. You know, it really can be a challenge, and we do need to have these little tricks and tips that we utilize in figuring out sugar in our food products, because there's over 200 different names for sugar. And, you know, the food industry, I don't know why they're allowed to do that. I don't know why. I think there should be a rule that they could call it, you know, brown rice syrup if they want, but they should have to put a parentheses that says sugar so that people know what it really is. But, you know, looking out for things, anything that says a syrup is a sugar, you know, even things that sound healthy, like agave syrup or agave nectar.
Oh, yes. See, that sounds great. And you think that's okay. You know, I'll get this agave. And then you find out that that's not too good either. Okay. Again, I'm going to ask you to hold your thoughts because I would like us to continue on this stream. But we need to take a brief break. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm talking with Dr. Nicole Avina. We're going to take a break.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Dr. Avina, I had to interrupt you when we were talking about identifying sugars and syrups and all that. Would you continue your thoughts?
Yes. So I think that coming up with, you know, a strategy where you're able to at least identify some of the different types of sugars that are out there is essential, because like I said, there's so many different names for it, over 200 different names. And one thing that, again, you can look at is if it's something that sounds healthy, sometimes that's not always the case. So fruit juice concentrate, that's a good example. Fruit juice concentrate is essentially just sugar. It's the sugar that you take a fruit and you squeeze it to death and you get all the sugar out of it and you throw away the fiber and the nutrients and you basically just boil it down to the sugar. And that's what fruit juice concentrate is. So we have to just be mindful that a lot of these sugars are in disguise. And sometimes that disguise could be a healthy food. And so you do need to pay attention to those ingredients lists. And, you know, one of the things that I think we have to our advantage that we didn't have, you know, 50 years ago, but I guess we didn't need it because we didn't have all these different, you know, ingredients, is that, you know, most of us have a smartphone. And if you're looking at something and you don't know what it is, you could quickly look it up. And I think that, you know, it's essential that we start to do that and not just blindly assume that because it's in the grocery store, it must be safe and good for us. Because that's not always the case. And, you know, I had this conversation with my younger daughter, my 8-year-old, the other day. We were, you know, having that important conversation that parents need to be having on an ongoing basis with their children, unfortunately now as young as 8, about the dangers of drugs. And, you know, I was explaining to her that you never take a pill or you never take something that you don't know what it is because it could be drugs and there, you know, there could be something in there that could hurt you. And it dawned on me, you know, we do this every day with our food. We're consuming foods that contain ingredients that most of us don't even know what they are. And I think that we really need to start to think about this in a different way, because we assume that just because, again, it's in the food, it's healthy. But we know that not all foods are good for us. Not all foods are healthy foods. And so I think we really need to be more cognizant about learning what those ingredients are so that we can make a decision about whether or not that's something that we want to eat.
How does one start to reduce the sugar in their life? We have people are listening to this program, and parents might say, well, gosh, you know, they've hit some good things, and there's some things that I could correct or do. Where do they start? How do they start?
Well, it can be overwhelming, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write my book, Sugarless, because I wanted to help people and help to lay out a plan to make this approachable and reasonable. Because let's face it, people have failed at regulating their diet and eating healthy, right? We wouldn't be having this conversation if everybody had it all figured out.
That's true.
And so it's difficult. And so really breaking it down into simple steps, tangible, easy things that you can do little by little to slowly have the changes and implement changes so that they'll stick. I think everybody is looking for that quick fix. You know, we all want to lose 20 pounds in 10 days or whatever the latest, you know, promise is. And unfortunately, if you really want to protect your health, you have to be like the tortoise and the hare, where in that fable, if you remember, you know, the tortoise was slow and steady, and the tortoise ended up winning the race because the tortoise took their time and didn't get ahead of themselves. And I think that's what happens with our diet, and we need to really do that. So where to start? One place people can start is their beverages. Okay. Beverages are the biggest source of added sugars for most individuals, and they are the easiest thing for us to consume. Because if you think about it, I mean, if I asked you to eat 5 apples, it would probably take you a while and you might not be able to do it, right? And if I, though, said, hey, I'm going to take these 5 apples and chop them up and stick them in the blender, I bet you could down those 5 apples in no time by drinking them.
Yes.
And, you know, so that's what happens with beverages. We're not as satiated by our beverages as we are by whole foods that we have to chew. So start with your beverages, recommending, you know, looking at things like your coffee, that if you drink soda, how do you change that?
Coffee.
Really just thinking about how you can make swaps to make it less sugar.
I think coffee is a real culprit because, you know, people add so much to their coffee, and then we have a coffee shop on every corner. But of course you don't go in and just get black coffee. You get something else to go with it. I mean, something else in it. Yeah, it's a frappe or something, okay?
It is. And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that because I've been thinking about that a lot lately. I don't even know how these coffee shops are still allowed to call themselves coffee shops because there's hardly any coffee in there. It's mostly sugar.
I mean, it doesn't even look like coffee. By the time you get it, it looks like maybe it's hot chocolate or something. Okay.
It does. It's more of a dessert, if anything, than a coffee. I mean, it's really, I think, something that it's interesting to me because I remember when coffee shops kind of first were a thing, you know, the chain coffee shops at least. And you literally would go in and get coffee. That was it. And now, I mean, you know, have to stare at the menu for a few minutes to even see where the coffee is on the menu.
I know. As we talk about all this sugar, is there any good sugar?
Well, you know, I don't like to use the good and bad card.
Well, okay, negate that, take that, throw that away. But what word would you like to use? Is there any sugar that can be beneficial? I know our bodies do need sugar to some degree, right? Our you tell us.
Okay. Well, you know, you're right. We do, we need sugar, but you have to keep in mind our bodies will make sugar for us. And so we don't need added sugar,
right? Okay.
If, you know, we're eating a wholesome diet, we don't need to have added sugar. We can survive just fine, you know, by making sugar ourselves. Our bodies are excellent, excellent machines. But one of the things that we need to keep in mind, and this question comes up quite a bit, is, you know, are there certain types of sugar that are healthier than others?
Okay.
So, for instance, is maple syrup better than, you know, high fructose corn syrup, or is, you know, one of these, you know, other types of sweeteners like maybe honey going to be better for you? Well, and my answer is, you know, they're all sugar. And yeah. It's really about reducing as much as you can, because there isn't one that's necessarily going to be, you know, better for you when it comes to the addiction and when it comes to the health effects.
But, you know, we're conditioned to think that things like honey are better for us. It's natural, you know,
this, right.
And so therefore that's better for us than pure old white granulated sugar. You know?
Right.
I mean, I think we are conditioned to think that brown sugar is even better than plain white sugar. And then brown sugar, white sugar, just with some syrup or something.
Yes, exactly. Okay. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. But we're conditioned to think that.
You're right. And I think that when I hear that statement, I agree with it, that people are conditioned to think that. And what my reply typically is that, you know, just because something comes from nature or is natural doesn't mean it's good for us. I mean, think about, think about cocaine. Cocaine comes from nature too. The coca leaf, yeah. I mean, parts of South America, Colombia, where those plants grow, I mean, that's as natural as you can get, but you can very easily take coca leaves and process them and extract the good stuff and turn them into an addictive substance. And so I do think you're right that we are sort of lured by this false idea that just because it's from nature, it's somehow better. I think that, you know, things like honey, yes, honey has advantages in the sense that it's antifungal. It, you know, can help with allergies if you're having local honey, but it's not a license to simply just, you know, become a honey bear and just douse yourself in honey because it might be, you know, thought to be better than refined sugar. It's still sugar, and your brain doesn't know that it's honey. Your brain thinks it's sugar, and it is sugar, and it's going to react accordingly. And over time, you know, it's going to have the same effects.
Mm-hmm. What about, and I know I'm jumping around now because I know we don't have much time left, but what's your take on sugar substitutes?
Well, I think that for many people who are really hooked on added sugar, it can be overwhelming to feel like they, you know, have to give it up or cut back. And in those cases, the sugar substitutes can be helpful because people can use them as a crutch. But I say that with a caveat that it can't end there, because our reliance on sugar is really a reliance on sweetness. And we've done studies in my lab to look at this and have seen that it's the sweet taste that drives the addiction. And that's why all of these different sugars that are out there all seem to do the same thing, right? Because it's really not the type of sugar, it's the sweetness. And so the same goes for these alternative sweeteners. Now, I tell people, if you feel like it's going to help you to wean yourself off of added sugar, then that's great. But you eventually also need to reduce your reliance on those as well, because if you truly want to break the addiction and truly free yourself from the control that sugar has, you have to make sure that you're tapering off on those alternative sweeteners as well.
Does our brain respond the same way to sugar in food as it would to drugs and alcohol? And I'm thinking about maybe the release of dopamine. Is it the same? Can you just talk a little bit about that? Is the response the same? How does it differ?
It is the same. And, you know, this was one of I'd say, seminal studies that we did, you know, years ago in the lab, asking the question of whether sugar would release dopamine in the way that drugs and alcohol can release dopamine. And that's what really sets it apart, because food in general doesn't release dopamine. When you eat broccoli or, you know, have a salad, it's not going to release dopamine. And interestingly enough, when we first did this study in our lab rats, we found that when the rats were binging on sugar, it was releasing dopamine every single time they took a hit of sugar. And so this is like what happens with drugs and alcohol. This is why people feel euphoria and they feel pleasure when they, you know, have access to drugs and alcohol, is because of that dopamine spike in these reward-related regions of the brain.
And we see the same thing with sugar. They just build a tolerance and just need more and more and more to feel, get that same feeling, right?
Yes. Okay. And you know what? You never get that same feeling. Mm-hmm. It's this unachievable high that people are trying to get and they don't. And that's what gets people in this spiral of addiction. And we see it happening now with sugar. And I think we're seeing it happening, you know, in a way that is so much more pervasive than we ever would have imagined happening with drugs and alcohol.
You were talking about the seven steps. I think you talked about seven steps that one needs to follow, you know, as they begin to break their dependence on sugar. And I would characterize it, and I just want you to correct me if I am wrong, as when I think about them, you know, first was, you know, you got to identify and recognize, hey, I do have this addiction. Sort more like a change in one's mindset, because whenever you're going to make any kind of change, you got to acknowledge it first, right? You got to acknowledge that there is an issue there, okay? And then you move on to things that you're going to do. And I just wanted to know, is that the right way to think about it, acknowledging the issues and then making a change?
It is.
Okay.
And, you know, it's tough for some people to admit that they're addicted to something. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a stigma that we still tend to carry when it comes to addiction. And I think for some people, it's tough to admit that. And, you know, that can be part of what's holding them up from making changes. Others, you know, find it comforting to know that it's addictive, because then they don't feel like it's a moral failing. They don't feel like it's a lack of willpower. When people learn, and when I talk about this, when I give lectures on this topic, you know, many times people are so thankful to hear that the sugar is affecting their brain in this way, because then they know it's not them. They know it's the sugar. And that can motivate people to make those changes.
How do you address, in these last minute or so, how do you address when someone, let's say they decided they're going to make a change, they're really trying to do everything that is recommended, and then they have a slip? And usually when they have that slip, they just feel like it's all over. I've blown it. You know, I just can't handle it. I'm a weak person, whatever.
You know, that is one of the features of the book, Sugarless, and the plan that I outline, is that it's not linear. And because life isn't linear, we have this whole idea that, you know, you have to climb up the corporate ladder and you're always moving forward. And, you know, the reality of life is sometimes you got to step to the side because stuff happens. And that's how we need to approach sugar and approach these setbacks, because that's simply all they are, is sidestepping setbacks, where maybe we need to, you know, just reevaluate, you know, okay, what made us eat that, or what made us, you know, overdo it when it came to, you know, the cookies, and use it as a learning tool, not as a way to punish ourselves or as a way to throw in the towel and give up on all the work that we've already put in and all the accomplishments we've already made. We have to embrace those setbacks as ways to inform ourselves, so that hopefully in the future, if we encounter those situations, we can avoid them and not have the same setback happen. So I think setbacks have to become an inevitable part of the journey. And the faster people can start to look at them as learning tools and not as excuses to quit, the quicker that they're going to find that it's a sustainable, reasonable way and approach to reduce sugar in your diet.
I don't know if you can answer this in 15 seconds or so, but can one, how much does it cost to become sugarless? You know, people always talk about when you have go on a diet, it costs a lot to go on a diet. Does it cost a lot? And you can just say no, yay, no, because we're out of time.
You know, I think the costs are negligible if I were to have to put a dollar amount on it. But you got to think about, you know, the gains long term.
Okay.
I mean, you're investing in your life and your health.
Okay, well, it's time out for this edition of 411 Teen. A special, special thanks to you, Dr. Nicole Avena, author of Sugarless, for sharing your expertise. To my listening audience, I appreciate your time and your ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Lawson. If you would like to participate in the 411 team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 team at wfsu.org.